Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Colonel James G. Bitzes, Judge Advocate of U.S. Cyber Command at Fort Meade, Maryland. The topic of his presentation will be Cyberspace Operations, Some Legal and Practical Considerations from a Military Perspective. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 1st, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. U.S. Cyber Command is the military command responsible for planning and conducting operations in and through cyberspace to assure U.S. and allied freedom of action, to deny adversaries freedom of action, and to enable effects beyond the cyber domain. It also directs the operation and defense of Department of Defense networks to assure that secure cyber capabilities are available to support full-spectrum warfighting. Colonel Bitzes was born and raised in Omaha, Nebraska. After graduation from Creighton Law School, he practiced with a firm specializing in insurance defense and subrogation litigation. He received his commission through the Air Force Direct Appointment Program in March 1991. In addition to his other assignments, Colonel Bitzes has served as a deployed staff judge advocate on two separate occasions. The 458th Air Expeditionary Group, Romania, in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, and the Combined Joint Special Operations Aviation Component in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom from 2008 to 2009. Prior to assuming his current position, he served as staff judge advocate at the Air Force Headquarters Office of Special Investigation in Quantico, Virginia. Here now to introduce the speaker is Mary Ann Culhane, Dean of the Creighton University School of Law.
We are very happy today to be able to have Colonel James Bitzes, who earned his J.D. here in 1989 and was a longtime Omaha resident. He will talk to us today on cyberspace operations, some legal and practical considerations from a military perspective. Jim is currently stationed at Fort Meade. That's a place that has a place in, long had a place in my heart. My dad was stationed there in counterintelligence quite a long time ago when I was born in the Baltimore Women's Hospital out that way. I don't want to take too much of the time here, so Jim, thank you so much for
coming
today. Oh, I did want to introduce Denise. Jim's wife. Here.
She told me not to be dry, so I'll do my best.
And he told her not to make funny faces, but I overruled that.
Yeah. Well, I want to begin by expressing my profound thanks to Dean Culhane for her gracious invitation to speak with you here today. I also want to thank Professor Ed Morse for reaching out to me about the subject of my presentation and for helping me reconnect with my alma mater. It is gratifying to see Creighton Law School leading the way in the multifaceted, complex, and rapidly evolving arena that comprises the law pertaining to cyberspace. That's not an official endorsement, just a personal statement, which, by the way, even though I am standing here in uniform, my remarks do not represent the official position of the Department of Defense, United States Strategic Command. They've got a contingent in front, no pressure, or the United States Air Force. But to the point, I think it's critical that more members of the legal profession begin to understand the cyber domain and its attendant legal considerations, and I am very excited about the opportunity to speak with you about the area in which I practice in every single day. Military operations in cyberspace, some legal and practical considerations. I came to the cyberspace practice environment first as the general counsel for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, where we considered legal and policy issues related to the use of cyber capabilities to support law enforcement investigations and counterintelligence investigations, and now as the senior legal counsel for U.S. Cyber Command. Excluding deployments, I'm on my fourth tour as a staff judge advocate, which is like a senior legal counsel. And, you know, I can tell you that unequivocally the range of practice I encounter at Cyber Command, sometimes on a daily basis, is broader than anything I could have ever imagined. The world has certainly changed a lot. For starters, My son is in high school taking a course in ethical hacking and penetration testing. When I was in high school, I owned a calculator, and I didn't know how to work all the buttons. As the world has changed, so the demands on our military have evolved, and we must remain, as the military, at the forefront of warfighting innovation and technology. Judge advocates and our civilian counterparts have had to keep pace with this rapidly evolving environment, but the time-tested principles of the law of war, together with our Constitution and laws, remain our North Star. I will also say up front that I could not even begin to tackle all the issues that we confront in Cyber Command Legal without the support of the incredible team of legal professionals I'm privileged to lead and the folks sitting in the front row here who support us as well. I ran a list of topics in my mind one day of all the different practice areas we'd encountered in one day. Law of war, targeting specifically, I'll talk about that a little bit later, ethics, fiscal law, acquisitions, international agreements, national disclosure policy for classified information, labor law, intelligence law, legislative affairs, issues related to department-level chief of information officer-related matters, and for good measure, yes, even some military justice. I offer that to let you know that while I'm here to focus on one particular aspect of military operations, it does take a team of multidisciplined legal professionals to support an organization like ours. And for the students in the room, I hope it piques your interest in our practice environment. Again, that said, I'm here to offer you some legal and practical considerations related to the conduct of military operations in cyberspace. But in an effort to at least scratch the surface of this broad topic, I thought I would focus on four main areas. One, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Cyber Command. Two, cyberspace. Three, the cyber threat. And four, the role of lawyers in cyberspace to support our nation's defense and ability to project military power. So here we go. First, let's start with U.S. Cyber Command. As a United States Code Title 10 entity, United States Cyber Command is a sub-unified command under U.S. Strategic Command right here in Omaha. Cyber Command is based at Fort Meade, as Dean Culhane mentioned. My dad did counterintelligence in the Army, too, by the way. We have approximately 1,100 people, military, civilians, contractors, assigned with a congressionally appropriated budget for fiscal year 2014 of approximately $562 million. That runs across the gamut of operations and maintenance, research, development, test, and evaluation, and military construction. Cyber Command also has key cyber service cyber components: Army Cyber Command, Marine Forces Cyber Command, Navy Fleet Cyber Command, and Air Force Cyber Command. Together, these units are responsible for directing the defense and operation of the Department of Defense's information networks and helping to ensure freedom of action for the United States military and its allies, and when directed, for defending the nation against attacks in cyberspace. The United States Cyber Force, I would add as an aside, is projected to grow to approximately 6,000 by the end of 2016. So we're expanding as the threat is evolving. Moreover, United States Cyber Command has been delegated responsibilities by United States Strategic Command, our parent command, and those are as detailed in the President's Unified Command Plan. In order to accomplish these missions, United States Cyber Command is focused on a set of five priorities. One, working really hard to build trained and ready cyber forces that understand what it means to defend, exploit, attack, that are trained to a single standard across the Department of Defense, and that are trained to fight as a single joint force. Two, developing Cyber Command and control concepts for operating in cyberspace that can deliver integrated cyber effects to support national and combatant commander requirements. Third, we're creating a more defensible architecture, which recognizes that the network is a warfighting platform and not just for communications, through an improved understanding of our critical warfighting components. Fourth, ensuring and maintaining global situational awareness and a common operating picture. And fifth, last but not least, obtaining the authorities necessary and lawful to defend the nation. So on a daily basis, Cyber Command and its component commands are keeping U.S. military networks secure, helping to protect our nation's critical infrastructure from cyber attacks, assisting combatant commands, and working with other U.S. government agencies tasked with defending our nation's interests in cyberspace. Now, cyber is a team sport, and United States Cyber Command has several key partners, to include the National Security Agency, NSA, and the Defense Information Systems Agency, DISA. In December of 2013, the President of the United States decided to maintain the dual hat arrangement. It's what we refer to as, under this construct, my commander also serves as the Director of NSA, Chief of Central Security Services. NSA CSS has authorities and unparalleled capabilities for detecting threats in foreign cyberspace, attributing cyber actions and malware, and guarding national security information systems. DISA is vital to the communications and efficiency of the Department of Defense, and its people operate in conjunction with us at United States Cyber Command on a constant basis. We all work in conjunction with the extensive efforts of other federal government mission partners, particularly the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, FBI, and other departments and agencies. We also work with private industry and allies in the overall mission of securing our networks, identifying adversarial and criminal actors and intentions, building resiliency for federal and critical infrastructure systems, and investigating the theft and manipulation of data. All of these partnerships are critical to the effective and lawful support of the administration's whole-of-government approach to cyber. The main point I want to leave you here is that U.S. Cyber Command is putting in place foundational systems and processes for organizing, equipping, and operating our military cyber capabilities to meet cyber threats and conduct full-spectrum cyberspace operations. Okay, so if we start with the premise that cyber warfare would generally be considered to include operations conducted in and through cyberspace, then we must necessarily consider the next question: what is cyberspace? Now, I'm a lawyer who grew up not using a calculator very well, but nonetheless, hopefully you'll see as we run through this presentation why understanding that is important. Recently, we celebrated the 25th birthday of the World Wide Web. And while people debate about the actual birth date on the internet, I'm going to go with 40-something. Consider this. More data crosses the internet every second today than was stored on the entire internet 20 years ago. Last Friday, my former commander, General Keith Alexander, retired officially from almost 40 years of active military service. Secretary Hagel, during remarks at the retirement, threw out this little data point. Quote, today, more than 40 trillion emails are sent each year. There are 60 trillion web pages. The internet accounts for one-fifth of GDP growth among developed countries, and it continues to connect, improve, and transform the lives of billions of people. Adding to the complexity associated with the sheer quantity of data at something moving close to the speed of light over the internet, cyberspace is also arguably a domain which actually transcends other land, sea, air, and space domains by virtue of the layers that make it up. These layers consist, there are four, at least in my brain. The people layer, the cyber persona layer, which is the digital representation of an entity in cyberspace. Three, the logical layer. And four, the physical network layer, the computers, cables, routers, switches, satellites, and the like. And one rough estimate is that about 70% of what makes up the internet is privately owned. So, when you think about this picture as your operational environment, it quickly takes the shape of a strategic landscape, and legal issues abound. And the picture is getting more complex every day. In fact, the cybercom operational environment is one which literally changes every day, both the nature of our adversaries and their utilization of cyberspace. So it's difficult to oversell the complexity of cyberspace and ergo the complexity of actually trying to do cyber operations in order to project U.S. military power or defend the nation against a threat. We can't overestimate or underestimate the threat. Again, Secretary Hagel, during the course of his remarks last Friday, said, during the course of his remarks last Friday, which was about the span of about 15 to 20 minutes, he said, DOD systems during that time period will have been scanned by adversaries more than 50,000 times. So when one considers that cyberspace is really a mix of geography, technology, and people all converging at once at very high speed, one begins to understand the challenge facing those who would defend the nation from attack and integrate cyber effects into military operations. I think one also starts to appreciate how relatively easy it is for an actor with malicious intent to hurt us. General Alexander, now my former commander, observed that the trend, recently observed, that the trend is moving from one of exploitation to disruption to destruction. In October of 2012, former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta described probably one of the most destructive attacks in the private sector as seen to date, a computer virus used to infect computers in the Saudi Arabian oil company Aramco in mid-2012. Virtually destroying 30,000 computers. He warned that the greater danger facing us in cyberspace goes beyond crime and it goes beyond punishment. A cyber attack perpetrated by nation states or violent extremists could be as destructive as the terrorist attack on 9/11. President Obama warned in his 2013 State of the Union address that we know our enemies are, quote, seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. Secretary Hagel recently said, our nation confronts the proliferation of destructive malware and a new reality of steady, ongoing, and aggressive efforts to probe, access, or disrupt public and private networks and the industrial control systems that manage our water, energy, and food supplies. And finally, General Alexander recently reflected upon his tenure at Fort Meade since 2005, in testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee for the Cybercom posture hearing. And he said, quote, what we did not wholly envision were the sort of cyber campaigns we've seen in recent years. Intruders today seek persistent presences on military, government, and private networks for the purposes of exploitation and disruption. These intruders have to be located, they have to be blocked, and extracted over days, weeks, or even months. Our notion of cyber forces in 2005 did not expect this continuous, persistent engagement, and we have since learned the extent of the resources required to wage such campaigns, the planning and intelligence that are essential to their success, and the degree of collaboration and synchronization required across the government and with our allies and international partners. End quote. Threat actors who can hurt us are no longer limited to nation-state actors or terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. The prevalence of easy-to-acquire malware on the Internet, much of it free, is staggering. And to bring this full circle, changes in threat actors and their characteristics take place against an increasingly complex flow of communications data around the world. These are some of the challenges grappled with every day. And lawyers are front and center in this arena. So, that brings me to my fourth topic area, the one that my wife said was not supposed to be dry, but it's the law. So, I'm sorry, sweetheart. So, lawyers are retained by clients to provide opinions. And so it's not surprising to find that there are some differences of opinion, one or two, amongst lawyers about the role of the lawyer in cyber warfare. And while some have suggested that the complexities of cyber as a warfighting domain, together with the speed at which things happen in cyberspace, mitigate in favor of letting a couple fights play out, sans legal input, I suppose a kind of a no-holds-barred cyber cage match, I can't support that view, and it certainly is not DOD policy. In fact, it is expressly the policy of the Department of Defense to comply with the law of armed conflict during all armed conflicts, however such conflicts are characterized, and in all other military operations. This has been standing policy for at least the whole of my career, and I support it unequivocally. More recently, Professor Harold Coe, then legal advisor, Department of State, stated in what I suggest are equally unequivocal terms that, quote, international law principles do apply in cyberspace, and cyberspace is not a law-free zone where anyone can conduct hostile activities without rules or restraint. So while the debate over lawyers and cyber warfare is interesting, it is also academic from my perspective. My role, and that of my lawyers, is to ensure that all cyber command, cyberspace military operations are conducted in accordance with the law, international and domestic. We don't have time for a full discussion about the laws that pertains to military operations in cyberspace, but I would like to touch on some of the legal considerations that we in United States Cyber Command, as a Title 10 military organization, concern ourselves as we review potential operations. It may not surprise you we're going to begin with the Constitution. The President, as Commander-in-Chief, may employ the military to protect the national interests of the United States as he deems necessary, pursuant to his authority under Article 2, Section 2 of the United States Constitution. The President may delegate this authority and has implemented this authority through his Unified Command Plan, various execute orders, or exords, as we call them, and other military documents. Step one in our legal analysis is to ensure we understand how these documents, in particular the orders that direct forces to conduct military action, comply with the law. Because these documents will necessarily be used to prescribe DOD's mission, assign specific responsibilities to DOD elements, and will likely contain specific guidance as to how these elements will accomplish their assigned missions. Adding to this presidential authority, Congress affirmed the DOD has the capability upon the direction of the President and may conduct offensive operations in cyberspace to defend our nation, allies, and interests, and it did so as recently as the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, explicitly permitting the military to act in cybersecurity and cyberspace for national security purposes. Title 10 of the United States Code reinforces the authorities of the President and the Secretary of Defense to conduct traditional military activity for the purpose of national defense. So why am I talking about Congress when my Commander-in-Chief is the President? Well, let's add a third branch. As you've no doubt studied in your constitutional law course, and as a result of your thorough reading of Youngstown's Sheet and Tube versus Sawyer, right? Okay. Presidential constitutional, and I realize that's it's a phenomenal opinion, but it's challenging. I got it. But I would submit that one of the key takeaways from that is that presidential power is strongest with the implied or express will of Congress as expressed through statute. Did I do that okay, Professor Watts? Okay, good. Thanks. Thank you. Now, additionally, also pursuant to his Article 2, but Section 1 executive authority, the President may manage the business of intelligence in such a manner as prudence may dictate, including the authority to secretly collect intelligence for reasons of national security. Intelligence authorities have been delegated to the Secretary of Defense through Executive Order 12333 and have been further delegated throughout DOD through various issuances. Like any other operational military unit, we are a consumer of intelligence and responsible for ensuring that it is utilized in accordance with the law and is subject to proper intelligence oversight and policy and procedure. Moreover, I would be remiss if I did not state that protection of privacy and civil liberties is non-negotiable. It will go hand in hand with establishing security and defending the nation in cyberspace. We are a nation governed by the rule of law, and as lawyers in a military command, we are charged with ensuring our commanders are armed with the right legal information in a timely manner so they can make the decisions they need to accomplish the mission lawfully. One of the more interesting questions in this area, I believe, necessarily involves the question of what constitutes an attack or use of force in cyberspace. In my view, as a military lawyer, that's a word, the A word, attack, which should be used with caution, as it carries a very significant connotation. It's also a word which, in order to have meaning, requires a policy decision by the president. As a general matter of law, what constitutes a use of force in cyberspace is the same for all nations, and our activities in cyberspace would be governed by Article 2.4 of the UN Charter, the same way that other nations would be. With that said, there really is no international consensus on the precise definition of a use of force in or out of cyberspace. Thus, it's likely that other nations will assert and apply different definitions and thresholds for what constitutes a use of force in cyberspace, and will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. The United States, I submit that the United States would evaluate its individual defense rights, as well as the self-defense rights of other nations, consistent with international law, Article 51 of the UN Charter. This analysis would assess whether an illegal use of force had occurred, and whether a nation's inherent right of self-defense was triggered. But remember, ultimately, the decision as to whether the United States has been attacked and how it responds in self-defense belongs to the president. Now, once we receive a mission from the president or the Secretary of Defense, or Strategic Command, which involves the conduct of military operations, necessarily to include targeting, my office is charged with the responsibility to ensure that the legal principles relevant to evaluating whether targets in cyberspace are valid military targets in accordance with U.S. law, international law, and applicable rules of engagement, and advise commanders accordingly. My central point here is that while it might be tempting to conclude that because cyber is different from other warfighting domains, land, air, sea, and space, that some different body of law applies. That's not the case. In fact, we apply the settled principles of the law of war to the conduct of cyberspace operations. And this review process, this legal review process, will apply relevant legal principles to the specific facts and circumstances of the target and determine whether the target is a lawful target under the law of war. And we'll validate the target based on the most current intelligence, examine proposed courses of actions and capabilities, and address any other legal issues. This process necessarily involves consideration of four basic international law principles relevant to a legal analysis of targets: military necessity, avoidance of unnecessary suffering, proportionality, and distinction. Applying the principle of military necessity, acknowledged, it is unlawful for a party to a conflict to destroy or seize the enemy's property unless such destruction or seizure be imperatively demanded by the necessities of war. It's pretty foundational. Concerning targets, international law requires attacks be limited strictly to military objectives. Lawful military objectives are those objects which by their nature, location, purpose, or use make an effective contribution to military action and whose total or partial destruction, capture, or neutralization in the circumstances ruling at the time offers a definite military advantage. Given the nature of cyberspace, I should back up. I know that was a little cumbersome. I'm sorry. But given the nature of cyberspace, I suggest that the most interesting legal issues in this area necessarily involve issues related to dual-use infrastructure. And I'll talk about that a little bit later on. But regardless, specific issues regarding necessity must be addressed in a target legal review. The second principle, as to the avoidance of unnecessary suffering, the right of a party to a conflict to adopt means of injuring the enemy is not unlimited. Parties to a conflict must avoid the use of arms, projectiles, or material calculated to cause unnecessary suffering. At the core, military victory should be achieved at the cost of as little suffering as possible. Under international law, physical injury that is disproportionate to military gain is a factor in determining what constitutes unnecessary suffering. Examples of restricted weapons include incendiary devices and non-detectable fragmenting ordnance. Generally, cyber tactics, techniques, and procedures do not cause these effects, but if these effects are likely, they will be addressed, most certainly, in the legal review process. Next, commanders must make a proportionality determination in which they evaluate whether the proposed military action is expected to cause collateral damage. The bottom line here is that incidental civilian death or injury or damage to civilian objects may occur, but it may not be excessive in relation to concrete and direct military advantage anticipated by those actions. The military advantage refers to advantage anticipated from the actions as a whole in the full context of a strategy. That is to say, we don't look at targets in a vacuum, but rather in both the immediate and broader context of strategy. And finally, the principle of distinction, sometimes referred to as discrimination. This principle requires parties to a conflict to distinguish between combatants and the civilian population and property. The civilian population, as well as individual civilians, shall not be the subject of attack. A law of war violation will arise if the civilian population is intentionally targeted, or when collateral civilian casualties become excessive in light of the anticipated military advantage. DOD has defined an enemy combatant, in general, as a person engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners during armed conflict. This includes both lawful enemy combatants and unlawful enemy combatants, or unprivileged belligerents. However, customary international law permits the targeting of civilian property if it is used to sustain hostile forces. Now, in the cyber context, this issue frequently arises because of the dual-use nature of most cyber systems. Remember, I talked about the 70% of privately owned internet. Dual-use systems provide service and capabilities to the civilian population and are also used for military purposes. These dual-use systems are lawful military objectives if they make an effective contribution to the enemy. Examples of dual-use systems which may be lawful military targets include civilian-owned computer routers for command and control by enemy leadership, a supervisory control and data acquisition system which provides for distribution of electronic power to a military base and a local civilian community, as well as civilian bridges that carry roads and communication lines used by both enemy leadership and civilians. These systems are used by civilians, but also effectively may also be viewed as effectively contributing to the adversary's warfighting or war-sustaining capability. I'm not suggesting here that we're trying to militarize cyberspace. Far from it. But if we're going to conduct operations in this space, these are issues which must be carefully considered in warfare. So targets are not examined in a vacuum. While a single target may be significant because of its own characteristics, the target's real importance lies in its relationship to other targets within an operational system. Lawyers play a critical role in ensuring that our military conducts its operations in a manner which keeps faith with our nation's constitution, its laws, and international law through their careful scrutiny of all aspects of operations. And this is possible in cyberspace when you have lawyers, as I am fortunate to do, who are studied in both the art and practice of war, military operations in the kinetic environment, and who possess a significant level of understanding and technical understanding of the cyberspace environment. Just as a good litigator partners closely with the experts In order to understand the technical aspects of a particular case, we partner very closely with our operators to ensure we fully understand all aspects of an operation and the means used to support it. Again, these principles remain our North Star. I'd like to close by once again thanking Creighton University School of Law for the opportunity to speak with you here today. It's been my privilege to serve the nation as a judge advocate for the past 23 years, and certainly one of the highlights of my career has been service in Cyber Command and the opportunity to advise some of the most brilliant and dedicated men and women I've encountered. I hope my presentation has enhanced your understanding of Cyber Command, cyberspace, the cyber threat, and the role of lawyers in cyberspace to support our nation's defense, and the ability to project military power determines when the president determines the need arises. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Colonel James G. Bitzes, Judge Advocate of the U.S. Cyber Command at Fort Meade, Maryland. The topic of his presentation was Cyberspace Operations, Some Legal and Practical Considerations from a Military Perspective. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 1st, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and Lauren Ulrich, Marketing Strategist for the Creighton University School of Law, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.